I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 on a $99 flight to London. I am one of your, here in 2021, I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybar.
And I'm Phyllis Gove.
And with us today from the Screen Drafts podcast, it's our friend Clay Keller. Thank you for joining us, Clay.
Oh, guys, thank you for indulging my questionable idea to cover. I mean, you guys did say you're going to cover all the 99 movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure did, pal.
I took that to mean that this was going to happen eventually, no matter what.
Yeah.
And I may as well go down with that ship.
Here's what I'll say. I didn't know this movie existed. I don't know if you knew this movie existed, Kenny. So when we compiled our list of all the movies of 99, there's invariably been a movie here or there where I've been like, oh, that came out in 99.
Or that existed.
Or that existed. And your love for Monica Potter, Clay, is what really brought this to the forefront.
Sure.
Understandably, you wanted to talk about Monica on the pod, and this movie is going to give you that opportunity.
I want to talk about this.
Please.
Kenny's got questions.
He's got thoughts. Of course, I
always do. I have thoughts cloaked in the sheath of a question.
Sure.
No, but it's a real question because it's really going to dictate a lot of the direction of this podcast.
Okay.
Clay.
Yeah.
How much of your love for Monica Potter is ironic?
No.
Because I don't know you that well and I can't tell.
I have nothing. I have nothing but affection for Monica Potter, the person. She seems terrific. She seems like a real salt of the earth Midwestern lady with a good head on her shoulders, who I think is a good actor, and who I think is just charming that post parenthood she just left LA.
Yeah.
And went to do like a reality show, like renovating her childhood home and reconnecting with her childhood friends. Yep. And she's got a like a YouTube and Facebook presence that is very charming. She did a series on Facebook called Judge. I think it's called Judge Potter, where she determined what was better between two things that were completely unrelated.
Here's what I know.
Kay. I think Clay answered your question with his depth of knowledge of Monica Potter.
Yeah,
I just when you take Monica Potter, you assume there would maybe be one layer of charm and interesting things about her, and then when she just keeps coming up with new stuff, which is great. I like her a lot. I was a big Parenthood fan, so I was a big Christina Braverman fan. I thought she sort of got short shrift in terms of praise for that show. She did not have a flashy part until her she had a cancer storyline later on that show that got a lot of attention. But otherwise, I feel like a lot of the air was taken up on that show by the other cast, all of whom are tremendous. I think it's a great show. But
I would argue that that show never got really its due when it came to awards and sort of critical acclaim.
Oh, well, yeah.
I think that show was sort of existed in some weird purgatory. It was always kind of on the bubble. It never really fully connected.
But I do think people...
Oh, people love it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a well-regarded show. But
All that to say, I knew her just as Parenthood lady, and she seemed like somebody who was made in a lab to play a nice mom on an NBC show.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And when I discovered that she had a career that went back to the late 80s, and there was a 4 or 5 year period where she had her name above the title on studio movies, I was so blown away by it that I just became fascinated with her career path more than anything. And then, because I was the only person who ever talked about that, it became a low-key part of my brand, and then I had to embrace it. So it is at least a tiny bit ironic that I keep bringing it up all the time, but I do think it is a genuinely fascinating 90s career arc.
So what I think you did, Clay, it's a wrestling term. you worked yourself into a shoot. Do you know what that means? Does that make sense?
I'm figuring it out via context, yes.
Yes, you worked yourself into a shoot, which for our listeners, I've used this term on the pod before.
It's true.
But it's when you have a gimmick, and Clay's gimmick was, I think it would be funny to ironically love Monica Potter.
Right. Yep.
And then as you continued, you know, as you embraced it, you started to actually really love Monica Potter.
Yeah.
Now, I say this with... no judgment, because I've done this over and over and over again.
Same.
In my life. I did it with Joakim Noah, the basketball player, who was the silly guy on Florida who all my friends hated. So I loved him and wound up genuinely loving him to the point where I have a shirt that says I love Joakim Noah. And the only thing, and in my Twitter bio, the only thing I have is Joakim Noah fan. I did it with Stanley Tucci, who 20 years ago was kind of, you know, a weird, not particularly attractive, not particularly spectacular supporting actor. And that was everybody's favorite fucking actor in the world.
Yeah.
You know, I used to joke about how the Tooch was my favorite actor, and now he just might be. So, you know, I get it. Clay, you know, you have worked yourself into a shoot to the point where you're on podcasts like it's 1999,
right,
fishing in the deepest end of this ocean, mm-hmm, and coming up with a rotted shoe of a movie.
Yes.
With Monica Potter's name above the title.
Kenny, I don't know if you're aware of this. I mean, I don't know what you mean when you say rotted shoe. I've been led to believe that this is the greatest romantic comedy of all time, and it's British.
Yeah. That's a
who said that again? I read that too.
It was an actual pull quote on the box in Britain. I believe it was God, which publication was it?
It was not nothing. It was like the Guardian or some shit.
It was something serious.
It was like the Daily Mail or the Guardian or
Daily Mail or Daily Star or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this...
Someone who had to wake up and go back to work the next day.
Correct.
This is one of the ones you guys may have missed because it is a different released year on IMDb because it came out initially in the UK and then later in the United States.
So it comes out in the UK in 98. It comes out domestically in 99 under a different title. So internationally, this film is known as Martha Meet Frank, Daniel, and Lawrence. A great title. And then here, in an equally vague title, The Very Thought of You is what it is known stateside as. I mean... Here's I have a question for you guys because I watched Pulp Fiction the other night for AFI Club with my friend.
It's a good movie.
Yeah,
it's a
very good movie. That one's solid.
Well, the reason I bring this up is because it feels like in the wake of Pulp Fiction, and I was talking about this with my friends, the fractured narrative became all the rage, right? The idea of sort of like looping back on storylines and playing with time a little bit in order to take what and I'm not suggesting that that Pulp Fiction did this, but to take a straight line and breaking it up into pieces makes it not feel like as much of a straight line. We're even seeing it now with like This Is Us and stuff like that, like withholding information depending on the way that you're telling the story. Excuse me. And this movie does this for no particular reason. I mean, would you agree that the fractured narrative on top of the... I don't know what you would call it, the sort of inciting incident to some degree, or sort of the structure of it, of our lead character, apropos of nothing, going to his neighbor to who he thinks is a psychiatrist or a therapist to tell him this story because you needed a framework with which to work from is also aggravating in its own right too. What do you guys feel about the narrative structure of this film? Kenny's despondent right now.
Go ahead, Clay.
No, Kenny, please.
I think it sucks. Go ahead, Clay.
it undercuts absolutely anything the movie is trying to do. It does very much feel like they're trying to Pulp Fiction it and be like, oh, won't it blow the audience's minds if the unseen character that we reference 15 minutes in turns out to be our main character and we didn't know it. And I hate that type of shit. I rant about this all the time, mostly in relation to Westworld, but I cannot stand
fair.
I cannot stand a story withheld in favor of a twist that you see coming anyway. Mm-hmm. It drives me fucking insane.
Yeah. This is my soapbox too, dude.
I'm glad to hear it, Kenny. This movie is not romantic or funny or dramatic. This framing device, it kneecaps every single other thing you see it thinking it is. Uh-huh. And you just watch it and you're like, what is going on? Why has the ostensible main character, Monica Potter, not been on screen for 25 minutes? Why has the other ostensible main character, Joseph Fiennes, he also disappears for long stretches of time. Why are we supposed to care about the in America anyway? They led us to believe this was some Ben Affleck, Sandra Bullock bounce action, and it was not at all. It's not about the two of them at all. It's about this group of three friends four friends who also have no chemistry and do not seem to care about each other at all. So why does the audience care about them? It is such a weird movie that fails on every single level.
It's a lazy movie, too. Like, I think that we're all kind of saying the same thing, obviously. But so it should be said Peter Morgan wrote this film.
Peter Morgan wrote this film.
Yes.
This movie is proof positive that you can fucking come back from anything. You cannot die in this town. And this town I'm talking about, London, but you can't die.
It's true. Great.
I've never. We've seen some like amazing writers, write on some fucking dogs. For instance, we just did Doug's first movie.
Right.
Kenneth Lonergan was a writer on Doug.
Yep.
Like you can come back from anything, but Doug is better than the thought of you. Doug is definitely better than the thought.
Doug's first movie is a bad movie. This is a much, much worse film.
This is also a much, much worse film.
Peter Morgan going from this to The Crown, I would argue, is perhaps a bigger leap than Kenneth Lonergan going from Doug to his career.
Forget The Crown. Peter Morgan had Oscars 10 years ago.
That's true.
Yeah. He had an Oscar less than 10 years after this, right?
He went for The Crown?
The Queen. So less than 10 years. I think it is less than 10 years after this, right? It was like 07 or something like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Less than 10 years after this, he is winning an Oscar. And like, you know, I always thought, you know, the craziest Oscar of all time for, you know, me was, you know, even crazier than the wild Ben Affleck and Damon ones or even, you know, the son of a mobster who wins for Green Book.
Pretty crazy.
Was Akiva Goldsman because he wrote the worst, dumbest fucking movie I'd ever seen. And a few years later, I'm not saying Beautiful Mind is one of the greatest movies ever won. He just won for it. I thought that was wild.
And then after that, he went back to making the dumbest crazy, fucking movies you've ever seen. Yeah.
It's unbelievable that that Ron Howard even gave him that movie. But this is even crazier. If I knew that the very thought of you existed, this is so utterly incompetent.
Yep.
Utterly incompetent. Yeah. That it's unbelievable that not only The Queen, I watched The Crown last night. I think The Crown is the fucking greatest.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's incredible.
The greatest. I can't believe this is the same guy.
I also feel like it really needs to be said. You said it best, you know, this movie's incompetent, but this movie's incompetent on every level. Like, on the casting, on the, I guess you could call it production design, on the costumes, on the music. I mean, this thing is truly a top to bottom failure.
It's a top to bottom failure. But since no one's going to watch this, I feel like we really should.
Yeah, I'll give a synopsis very quickly.
Explain it as deeply and give a synopsis. But I don't know if it's lazy. I think it is too clever by half. I think it is tricking itself. That's out of being good. It is going so hard on we're going to have this like fucking like revolutionary, no one's ever done this kind of structure in a rom-com before, and we're going to try and have it full of this clever dialogue, and it's going to be all these great, they are disparately all good actors. I love Tom Hollander. I love Rufus Sewell.
Sure.
Joseph Fiennes, I don't have a lot of experience with. Sure. I like, and Monica Potter is she's doing everything she's supposed to be doing in this movie.
We're gonna have to unpack that in a second.
It is trying way too. I think it's not lazy. I think it is trying so hard that it just spins itself out of control.
I think there's validity to that. I think that the movie is definitely, it does think that it's clever.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily know that it actually digs beneath the surface in anything. Like it's entirely just spinning plates.
That's an interesting. This didn't happen so much in '99. We didn't see it that often, but we did see it a lot. Like you said, Phil, in the wake of Pulp Fiction in '95, '96, '97, right after Pulp Fiction happened, where people started to replace character development and classic structure and you know, depth and dynamics and all the things we like in movies with flash and bang.
Yep.
And I think that happened here, except the flash and the bang is not very flashy and not very bangy. Right? So I think, like, you know, when I was a kid, it was the third movie we did and I kind of want to revisit it. Go was like my favorite movie, but I was also like a baby, right? And I think what we realized, Phil, when we went back to Go, is Go kind of falls into that category of the movies that like did its best Pulp Fiction impersonation without any kind of like anything beneath the surface. But at least the flash and the bang were exciting.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Actually, to be fair,
Go is Pulp Fiction in comparison to The Very Thought of You.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
And The Very Thought of You does have, I mean, it does not have any flash. It does have two bangs. And they are on the sides of Tom Hollander's head.
They are.
They're sideburns.
Fucking incredible.
They're sideburns. Crazy. They're side bangs.
Crazy.
They are.
They are so big. They are side bangs.
His whole hair.
What is his character?
Oh my God.
Oh, his character.
I was not an adult in 1999. Adults were not dressing in this way in 1999. Were they?
No.
He's got on like a fucking like velour like disco suit.
This is also
the first thing I wrote, because we'll get into the synopsis pretty soon. But
yeah,
basically, he does some weird thing where he sees Monica Potter across a room and is like immediately in love with her, which, you know, okay, sure. And he gets every piece of information about her from the woman at the counter, right?
Which is
the woman at the counter just lays it all out.
Yep.
And my all caps curse word filled first note was, what a fucking creepy ass move with the plane.
Yeah.
Why did you tell him all that info about Monica Potter? It's weird Harvey didn't clock this. But we can't, you know, it's funny. We just did Bee Monkey, which is like a Harvey movie. And this is a Harvey movie.
Yep.
And this is a movie that, you know, the person with the final say has never in his entire life courted a woman. It's just that simple. He is a person who thinks like courting a woman is pointing out someone in a room, asking someone about that woman, what it takes to like get in that woman's, you know, bed. I don't even want to be too disgusting. And does it because he, you know, threatens them into pulling them from the movie. Mm-hmm. So yes, this is a creepy ass fucking movie. It's not going to get a good grade for me, but let's get into it.
Let me give a very brief synopsis because no one's seen this movie and nor should they. Bored with her job at a Minneapolis car rental agency, restless Martha, played by Monica Potter, impetuously takes a trip to London. On her adventure, Martha encounters three Englishmen who coincidentally all know each other. There's music bigwig Daniel, played by Tom Hollander, card champion Lawrence. Literally, we don't even see him fucking play cards.
He teaches a card class at the very end of the movie.
Card champion Lawrence, played by Joseph Fiennes, and aspiring actor Frank, played by Rufus Sewell. All three men end up pursuing Martha, oblivious of each other, which of course results in an elaborate romantic entanglement. As we mentioned, the film's written by Peter Morgan, directed by Nick Hamm. The Very Thought of You opened on August 27th, 1999, behind The Sixth Sense, 13th Warrior, and Runaway Bride. It would go on to make $3 million worldwide. The Very Thought of You has 33% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 60% from audiences.
All right.
I'm going to read two very quick clips. The New York Times said, one of those coyly edited movies that fills in the mystifying gaps in its story by periodically doubling back to repeat a scene with new crucial information added. To maintain its fizz, a comedy like The Very Thought of You requires the spicy contemporary equivalent of Noel Coward banter. But if the story is a clever sitcom-y contraption, the dialogue is pedestrian. Among the contestants for Martha's Love, the only character with a distinctive personality is Hollander's vain, petulant Daniel, whose ego is in need of puncturing. As a shy, tongue-tied Lawrence, who needs lessons in self-aversion, finds lacks the debonair twinkle and comic timing of Hugh Grant, who might have made the role come alive. As for Miss Potter's Martha, the character is a fabrication that not even Miss Roberts, with all her wiles, could have made believable. Variety said, the lack of real chemistry between the leads and unsteady direction by Nick Hamm dampen an otherwise promising screenplay by Peter Morgan. I want to just...
There's a couple of good lines in this movie. Just in a vacuum, there's a couple of good...
moments, sure.
Not even moments, just lines.
I think it's worth mentioning that Monica Potter beat out Nicole Kidman, Jennifer Aniston, and Courtney Cox for the lead role in this movie, which is sort of insane. Kenny is looking wistfully at the horizon, thinking about what it might have been.
I mean, it's interesting. Nicole Kidman would have been wild. I almost want to table that discussion for a second. Either the Friends Girls would have been, you know,
fine.
One of the movies that they made, and it would have disappeared in the ether like this did.
100%.
But I do feel like we have to talk about Julia Roberts.
Yes.
Because they brought it up in the review. She looks so much like Julia Roberts.
Sounds like her too.
It's such an, and we, you know, we just did Steel Magnolias. We got Julia Roberts on the brain, and you know, it's an impersonation almost. It's crazy. It's like she's like, it's like she's Nicola. It's like she's
a Time Store Julia Roberts.
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna say it's like she's Kim Basinger in fucking L.A. Confidential, cut to look like who was it, Vera Lake or
Veronica Lake.
Yeah, like that's what it felt like. They're like, oh, we can't get Julia Roberts, let's build one. So, does this movie? How much better is this movie with Julia Roberts? A little.
a little.
Or not at all?
I don't know. That character makes no sense and is given nothing. So I feel like even a great... I mean, look, I agree with that review. Had Joseph Fiennes' character been played by
Hugh Grant,
that maybe could have been something. Yeah. Martha is such a manic... I mean, she's not even a manic pixie dream girl. She's like a passive pixie dream girl. She's just like wanders around and these men insinuate themselves upon her.
There's
and
nothing that makes
she
me
has nothing
think
to
any
do.
Of them would want... Yeah, why would any of them want to be with her? I say that with all due respect to Monica Potter, but the character of Martha is so completely vacuous that it's just like these men are losing their minds over this person that I have no idea why.
Oh, and vice versa, to be fair. It's obvious why she has no interest in, what are their character names, in Tom Hollander or Rufus Sewell, because they're both just completely awful and unappealing with no positive characteristics in any way, shape, or form. And then she falls in love with Joseph Fiennes, who is an absolute dud. And it's, she's got a sparkle in her eye. She's cute. I get to see her across the room and be like, oh, Monica Potter. And I find her personally charming. And yeah, Kenny, you're right. I think she obviously looks like Julia Roberts. I think she maybe inherently has a Julia Roberts-ness to her, which I think is both why she almost had a career and then also why she then did not.
Sure. But can I,
because
can
there
I also-
wasn't room for more than one Julia Roberts, and Julia Roberts is the better Julia Roberts. And Monica Potter found her lane later, playing less Julia Roberts
but
characters.
I would also argue too, you know, we talked about Con Air on our Screen Drafts episode.
Yeah.
She's not in that movie much, and she pops so much more in Con Air than she does in this, which is, I think, a symptom of this movie is abhorrently directed. I mean, it does no one any favors. So I think she has something. It's just not mined well. Say some shit.
That might, you know, might be problematic, but I'll say some shit because it's Hollywood. You guys have read William Goldman's Adventures in the Screen Trade or More Adventures in the Screen Trade. I can't remember which one this anecdote is from. But he wrote Stepford Wives. And in Stepford Wives, I don't remember who the director was. It might have been Michael Davies. The director cast his wife as one of the Stepford Wives. And William Goldman's point was part of the reason why this failed is because his wife just didn't look like a Stepford wife. Wasn't viable as a Stepford wife.
Right, right.
Part of the, you know, conceit was that these women were basically, you know, created in a lab for men's pleasure. Monica Potter's appeal is as the girl next door, as the underdog, as the girl that, you know, that you find long-lasting happiness with after you, you know, sow your wild oats or something like that. There's like, it was part of that, like that brain fuck that I felt when Amy Smart went from that character in Varsity Blues to the sex pot in Road Trip a year later. Like Amy Smart is the girl you go home to. And
who I also like Amy Smart a lot. I'm learning some. Kenny, this is you are my Ray Winstone on this podcast. You're really
well.
You're revealing my type is apparently that.
Well, the type is like down to earth. You know, the type is like realistic. I don't mean like realistic like your shot, like a real person. Mm-hmm. And Monica Potter, like, really, she does read like a person you would.
Yep.
See at an airport, or a person you would, you know, go out on a blind date with, or a person like those things. But she's not Julia Roberts in fucking Ocean's 11, where like the world stops when she walks down the stairs. And you either need that, and that's not just a function of her, you know, physical attractiveness. That's an aura, right? That's not just a function of what she looks like. It's like, you know, you need that thing for me to believe that these guys would drop everything and, you know, pursue her. But even more.
Or we need to spend enough time with the character that we understand why people fall in love with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's furthermore, right? So there's two aspects to this. One is the love at first sight, they all fall in love with her right away. And the other one is why they stick around. And neither of those things, you know, compute in this film.
Correct.
To me, it's an and, right? It's not an or, it's an and. You absolutely do also need to understand why the movie that did it perfectly, perfectly, was Something About Mary.
Oh, sure, sure.
Mary, like, yeah. Cameron Diaz is like a goddess and also like the fucking best.
Yeah, the
right?
coolest.
Also, like, yeah. You get why like all of these guys are losing their minds over it. And then on top of that, it's funny. And on top of that, it, like, the whole thing just works, right? Like, now, I've thought a lot about that movie recently because I feel like that one might be a little problematic these days. But
I would say so.
A little bit.
I would think so, know, yeah.
When
yeah.
we were talking to Lola about mm-hmm. Say Anything, I'm like, Say Anything's not the one. Something About Mary where he
yeah.
is traveled. Is it because Brett Favre is in it?
Favre, yeah. Brett Favre? Yeah, he's been canceled, I hope.
He's been canceled, but he accepted some invitations. He like went to the White House and hung out with Trump or something like that.
He
was canceled in my
full-throatedly endorsed him.
Yeah.
Along with Jay Cutler and Jack Nicklaus. Don't think I don't have a list. I got a list.
So Kelsey Grammer too, apparently, which I didn't know.
Kelsey Grammer, yeah. I mean, anyway. Kelsey Grammer's a weird person.
He's a weird guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think,
did we talk about the plot?
Not we will. But oh. I just want to quickly
this podcast is far from over.
I wanna hit just a couple quick things. I think absolutely what you're saying about the Monica Potter manic pixie dream girl thing. But I want to circle back to the Nicole Kidman thing that we kind of put a pin in for a second. Because I think the Nicole Kidman thing is also wrong in different ways, right? Like, if Nicole Kidman is plopped in this movie, I'd understand the holy shit, who's that, right? Because at that time, and quite frankly, still, she has what you're talking about, Kenny, which is this sort of the aura of a, you know, a larger than life kind of person, right? Like something that you would unquestionably notice. Now, I don't think that she's
Aquaman's mom.
She created Aquaman. She's Satine, but yeah, there's something about her. I don't necessarily know that this role is written well enough for Nicole Kidman. Obviously, it's not. Like, there's just no depth.
Can
there.
You imagine this in Eyes Wide Shut?
Oh my
Same
God.
Year. That's Nicole Kidman's 1999.
How crazy! I mean, but that's so. My point here is that I think that this thing was DOA. No matter who's in it, really, but it makes sense that Monica Potter beats out these people because I think it's not right for Nicole Kidman. Jennifer Aniston and Courtney Cox are, like you said, Kenny, they're TV actors at the time. And I guess they thought they had lightning in a bottle with Monica Potter, that they thought, like, we found the new girl.
I mean,
it goes back to the screenplay, but their idea, unless they changed it to fit Monica Potter, the idea of a, you know, broke rental car employee from Minneapolis.
Yep.
Going to England and then having her. I mean, I guess it is supposed to be sort of this fantasy of I've never been out of the country. I fly to London. Suddenly three British guys are all in love with me.
The worst three British guys.
The worst.
As an Anglophobe.
But I feel like part of it is supposed to be that this doesn't make sense in a fantastical sort of way. It isn't, she's not supposed to be Julia Roberts strutting off of the plane and everybody's hearts stop. I think it's supposed to be, what is this ineffable magneticism about this Midwestern, mm-hmm. random Midwestern girl who shows up in London? But then it just doesn't, it's inert dramatically because it doesn't make sense.
You know, as you guys were talking, something kind of occurred to me. Doesn't this movie feel like it could have been a storyline from Love Actually?
Oh,
like,
sure.
It feels like, you know, it kind of was, maybe, right?
Kind of in reverse, where the British
guy goes to Wisconsin.
Yeah. Goes to Wisconsin.
Yeah.
In that way, and I say that I'm not a Love Actually fan because a lot of Love Actually has just a bunch of like dot, dot, dots on storylines that just don't resolve themselves because they're just like, whatever, I saw Magnolia. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of feels like it just doesn't really go anywhere. And this movie feels that way too, where it's just sort of like, this is a thing, if it was in a bigger movie, it's a storyline that I wouldn't have thought that much about and it would have been fine. But for it to be the entire film unto itself, it just has to go deeper. It has to be better.
I think the Love Actually, you know, illusion is fair. I think the reason Love Actually works really well, and it's a great movie, is because it kind of knows what matters and what doesn't. So sure. The Wisconsin storyline is played as absurd fantasy.
Correct.
And there's a little kernel of something there that I think is really true, which is American women like European accents. And that's the joke. That is the joke. You put these this incredibly weird looking dude and Shannon Elizabeth falls head over heels for him. The reverse, the character Monica Potter is given. And Clay, I think you were pitching something that would make this movie better. It's not even just giving her a depth of character that we would have been attracted to, but some specific character traits.
Yes.
That we don't see, or that the Brits don't see very often.
Yes.
Right? Where she shows up, like if she showed up and she was a cowgirl from Oklahoma.
And she's not exotic, is your point.
No, right. Yeah. I'm saying she was a cowgirl from Oklahoma. Then at least I'm starting to say, oh, that's like something they maybe not have only never have seen, but maybe they've seen someone like that in the movies. Maybe they have a Sharon Stone for Quick and the Dead thing going on. And you're just like, oh, this is new or just things Americans have. So like a surfer chick or like a skater chick or like a like all these like it's I always like feel a little insecure as an American, particularly a white American. Because I am sensitive and kind of buy into the idea that our culture is lacking, that our culture is in a lot of ways taken from white Europeans and Black Americans and other, you know, people in America. But Americans haven't created that much. But if you dig a little deeper, we have our own subcultures that are our own, right? Like surf culture, particularly California surf culture, is our own. Pioneer culture is our own. You know, this stuff is stuff that we can export and other people will find exotic and attractive. But what she brings to it, and Clay, you could speak to this as a Minnesotan. There's got to be something about Minnesota that is uniquely Minnesota that
money. I agree. They should have made Monica Potter a pioneer surfer, and this movie would have Minnesota. This movie would have sung.
Go ahead.
Look, she's very good casting for a Minnesotan because she's just sort of pleasant, and
I listen to all 6 hours of the Minnesota Screen Draft, which I love, by the way. That is the brand of Screen Draft that's really for me.
Mm-hmm.
Minnesota sounds cool.
Minnesota is cool and interesting. But again, I think the screenplay has a lot of like, wouldn't it be different if, and then that's all the further the idea went. And he forgot that for an audience to care about characters, they have to make sense. And there has to be some sort of, you know, connection that the audience makes. I mean, our two romantic leads who on the American poster are the only two people. We forget Tom Hollander and Rufus Sewell on the American poster. If you went to see this movie because you loved Shakespeare in Love, the first 40 minutes is fucking Tom Hollander with an insane haircut acting like the world's biggest douchebag. Like, what a bait and switch. But the two leads don't meet until 40 minutes into the movie.
He reminded me of a British David Spade, which is, you know, which is essentially the biggest insult I can give somebody. Two things I despise, the Brits and David Spade. And Rufus Sewell reminded me of like Michael Shannon as his murderer-iest.
Correct.
So these are two of the least attractive characters I could possibly remember.
I want to talk about Shakespeare. I want to talk about something very quickly because it did sort of occur to me as when we were talking a little bit about Love Actually a few minutes ago, because in 99, we have arguably one of the greatest romantic comedies ever made in Notting Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Julia Roberts, Hugh Grant. These two movies, on the face of it, obviously these are very different films, but these two movies on the face of it are not that dissimilar. And yet, one of them just absolutely exceeds and sort of it gets outside itself in terms of genre. Part of it is the fact that Richard Curtis, I think we can all agree, is very good at this, right? Like, he understands how to write a great British romantic comedy that travels, that works in North America as well as works in Britain. This movie is just all of those things badly done. Like, I don't think that Peter Morgan, if we're being honest, cares about the romantic comedy, right? Like, it felt... Yeah. Like, it's quote-unquote beneath him. And quite frankly, his career has shown that, right? Like, he's gone in completely different directions, and he has exceeded and excelled in that way. Notting Hill is everything this film wishes it was. So I do wonder whether or not, on some level... And by the way, so this movie comes out in August, and Notting Hill comes out in July. So, like, you know what I mean? Like, or May. I think, actually, sorry, it came out the same weekend as Star Wars. But, like...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You can't follow that up. You can't put another fucking romantic comedy.
People are seeing Notting Hill for the third time instead of
this fucking thing. Yeah. Like, it's just, it's not even, it never had a chance. This thing was just, I mean, I'm sure it was just dumped. I mean, it barely registered. But I want to talk for a quick second here about Joseph Fiennes, because you said it, Shakespeare in Love comes out in 98, comes out in the, I guess, you know, Oscar season 98. Yeah. Obviously it wins. How did Joseph Fiennes not really have a career?
Maybe he can only do the one thing. Maybe he could.
It's crazy.
What else have I seen him in? I mean, I've seen this. Yeah, maybe some like recent stuff.
But it's like
maybe I don't know. I haven't seen enough of his stuff to comment on.
But in 98, he's got Shakespeare in Love and Elizabeth.
Right.
So he's in both of those films. He's in the Best Picture winner, another Best Picture nominee. And no career?
It's so weird. It always kind of felt like I'm not even convinced he wants to work.
Right.
Because like he's, what's wrong with him?
Yeah.
Like what? Like I think it's not even that he's great or good or whatever, but he's like good looking and British and has a great last name. And, you know, like he matters. He matters when like he was a nobody. When Shakespeare in Love came out.
Yep.
And the only reason anybody gave him the time of day was because he was his brother's brother.
Correct.
So it was weird. And then he was in that show. Remember that show that came out, Fast Forward?
Oh, that's right. Flash Forward.
Flash Forward. One of the lost, like, it was like kind of the first, like, now we're going to try to make a bunch of Lost shows. And he was the star of that.
Yep.
That seemed weird to me at the time. But it also was like proof positive that, no, Joseph Fiennes does want to work. And remember when he almost played Michael Jackson?
Correct. Oh man, that would have been, that is like the biggest dodged bullet lost project of all time. Or didn't that get made and it never came out or something? Michael Jackson and Bubbles was there and someone was Elizabeth Taylor and it was about like a cross-country road trip after 9/11.
He also was the lead in the Ryan Murphy trans project that shot a pilot for FX where he played a man who goes through sex reassignment surgery or whatever, however the best way to describe that is.
You got it.
called 7 ounces or something like that?
Oh, no, it's a gender affirmation surgery.
My apologies. And it was originally, it was titled after the weight, the average weight of male genitalia, but then they changed it to like pretty something. Anyway, long story short, it never saw
the light
of day.
Maybe he's just weird. If he was down to play Michael Jackson in something, maybe he's just a little bit kooky. Yeah. But also, I mean, Kenny hit a good point. I was watching Backdraft last night. Billy Baldwin.
Yeah.
Another guy gets a career because of his brother. He's not a bad actor. He's in a couple of big hit movies, and then he disappears. You know, it's
why are we
also on Parenthood?
Are
you doing a fire draft?
Are you doing a fire draft?
No, I was just watching it. I was just. What's you a good movie? No, I
just watch movies.
Very rarely.
I don't know how you have time.
I like to catch up on 90s studio movies before I go to bed. So I watch like a half a movie, and then the next night I'll finish it. But they're an easy thing to watch when you're tired. It's like cut and dry, big glossy studio stuff. And I'd never seen Backdraft, even though I love going to Universal Studios Hollywood, and they still talk about Backdraft at that place 28 years later.
Have you gotten to the De Niro, Donald Sutherland scenes?
Oh, I finished Donald Sutherland as Fire Hannibal Lecter. I absolutely have. It's terrific.
Backdraft was a big deal.
Yeah,
it's like, movie. Yeah. It's the same year as Silence of the Lambs. So they must have read the book and been like, "What if we take Hannibal Lecter?" Or you know, they saw fucking like Manhunter, and they're like, "What if we take Hannibal Lecter and make him a pyromaniac?" Mm-hmm. And then they're like, "Ah, oh, fuck! They're doing a real Hannibal Lecter movie this year too." Damn,
I want to watch it. That sounds good.
Sutherland's good.
Sutherland's very good.
I saw that a long time ago, 25 years ago. But
I think you would really like Backdraft, Kenny.
Jason Lee's in this flick. Rebecca De Mornay is in this flick.
Wait, yeah. Clay, can we do a fire draft?
Are there enough?
Firestorm.
There's like Ladder 49. Firestorm.
Are there any good fire movies?
Yeah,
here's the thing. Everybody, I like the drafts where you have to play some bad movies, but everybody is always like, are there enough good movies? But no, Rebecca De Mornay, this is how 90s this movie is.
Kurt Russell
dies in the opening scene, and you're like, wait, I thought Kurt Russell was the star of this movie. Flash forward 25 years, Kurt Russell playing his own son. Yes.
Oh, that's so good.
That's it's how really, good Backdraft really good. Is.
Yeah.
It's any really case,
good. Scott I like Glenn, that. I mean, like, it's got a really solid cast.
Oh, he's hanging out with all the Hannibals.
yeah, exactly.
That's really good.
Billy Baldwin. Same guy, identical.
Okay, so basically, long story short, I mean, there's really not a ton of plot. It just it's told in a
What's
way
this
that
movie
thinks it's
about?
Clever. Basically, Martha is working a dead end job at this Minneapolis car rental agency. She quits, cashes her final paycheck, uses it to purchase an airline ticket to the least expensive international destination she can find, London, which is horseshit.
None of which you get to see,
and also like London's not the cheapest ticket.
So absolutely,
stop it. I mean, that's insane.
Yeah, but I mean, international, fucking take a train to Ontario.
Exactly. Go to
Saskatoon.
So she meets this guy, Daniel, who's this successful music label executive who basically arranges for her to get a first-class ticket so he can sit next to her, which is a total fucking creep show thing to do, as Kenny mentioned earlier. But then she susses out that he's done this, which I have no idea how or why she would know that he did this, but she does. And she decides to sell her first-class ticket to be back in coach. And then he switches seats again. Like, this is like straight up stalking at this point.
This is the thing. At this point, the movie acts like this is supposed to be
cute.
Charming. Because this is this rich guy who's used to these luxuries. His scheme didn't pan out.
Yeah.
So he's going to go sit amongst, you know, the fucking herd of disgusting Thanks. People yeah, in, yeah, yeah. In coach.
Yep.
This is the problem through the entire movie. Look, if the inciting incident of this movie of like Joseph Fiennes and Monica Potter, the normal attractive people getting together, if the thing that kicked this off was his creepy weirdo cartoon character friend had a crush on her, if this is 5 minutes of the movie, okay, maybe that's funny. Maybe that's
the whole
different.
Movie.
No, it's the first. They give these go nowhere goofy comedy like attraction sequences with the two people who are deeply, deeply, desperately unappealing.
Yep.
30 minutes each.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And the audience never believes for a second that they are a romantic rival or that that one of them may woo her away. Never for a second. And you're just watching this and it just feels sad and weird and uncomfortable. Yeah. And it gives us no time at the end of the movie to care about the couple we're supposed to care about.
It's also
insane.
It puts it, and Kenny and I have talked about this on other episodes too. It puts so much weight on the script, right? Like it makes it so that it is all on these two actors and the direction and everything. Like it all has to sing perfectly for you to be able to have essentially a two-hander for the whole movie, but different two-handers.
Yeah. That is. You hit on my number one biggest problem with this movie and why this movie means absolutely nothing to me. This movie has nothing going on except for this romantic plot.
Yep.
Right? So even a movie like Notting Hill, which is like, you know, swoon-worthy romantic, also has the story of Julie Roberts' career happening behind it, right? The story of Hugh Grant's friends and his bookstore. There are things happening in this world that makes me feel like there's a, you know, there's dimensionality to what's happening.
Yeah.
So that being said, you don't need to have that. The fucking Sunrises, the before series don't have it.
Yep.
But they have incredible dialogue that has something to say about love and loss and the passage of time. This movie has nothing to say.
Yep.
So if it has nothing to say except for the most unbelievably rote things about love and timing and attraction, and also doesn't have any plot carrying us through that makes worried about these characters, concerned. I mean,
yep.
Simple things like you make Monica Potter, you know, with all in poverty. She is an impoverished person.
That is when she says, "I wrote this down, Ken." There, she's trading how bad her life is scars with Rufus Sewell.
Yes,
and she says she lives in a housing project and makes $1.80 an hour, which
she guarantee you, Chili's that no one comes into.
I guarantee you, the minimum wage in Minnesota in 1999 was more than $1.80 an hour.
She had the money to get on a fucking plane.
Yeah, like,
she pulled together $99.
She also calls the Metrodome the Viking Stadium. So that's strange credulity as well.
The Viking Stadium. I know. Didn't she call the Mall of America the U.S. Mall at some point?
She calls it the Mall of America. And credit where credit is due, when they're talking about cute neighborhoods, and she's like, the place I like to go, she mentions Linden Hills, which is a real, she calls it the Linden Hills, which is not what it is called. It's called Linden Hills. But that is a cute Minneapolis. But again, someone living in a housing project who's making $1.80 an hour and looks like Julia Roberts. I don't know. This doesn't track. Linden Hills, if you want to know what it looks like, a lot of Jingle All the Way was shot there.
Oh, Kenny likes Jingle All the Way.
I hate Jingle All the Way. But I've seen it so many times. So my point was, like, everything you said, true, utterly absurd, also built-in conflict. Like, there's a built-in issue. This girl has no money.
Correct.
A moment do we feel that.
Nope.
But, like, she goes to London. Like that backstory is crazy.
Yeah.
But also it does beg certain things like, where are you going to sleep? How are you going to eat? Like, are you going there just to find random men to sleep on their couch? Like, if you are, okay. Now let's see what happens.
I mean, that's sort of what happens, but they don't ever. It's like she's just like drunk in the park, then she goes and stays with him. But she also just made $2,000 off of that that airplane ticket.
Yeah, but then she pisses it away on the fucking same bullshit at the end in order to get the first class ticket for Joseph Fiennes.
Wait, in the craziest scene of the whole movie, and the scene where, you know, I'll buy anything, but I won't buy this. She drinks out of Rufus Sewell's flask.
Yeah.
You are disgusting. Like, for all she knows, this guy is so gross. This guy is a petri dish of STDs. He probably is. Mm-hmm. But she drinks out of his flask.
It's so gross.
That's it.
I mean, her scenes with Rufus Sewell, who, by the way, from what I read online, apparently improvised a lot of his dialogue.
Oh, yes. I mean,
great. He's playing a sociopath. I mean, he's really crazy. He screams at her. He laughs maniacally. I mean, there's nothing about him that's even remotely interesting. Lawrence is, of the three options, certainly the most grounded, or certainly the most, I guess, believable that she'd end up with him. But you said
because he's not aggressively awful,
right?
It's like the three ice cream flavors are like vanilla, and then like one with like shards of glass in it.
Yeah, like rusty nails.
Yeah, then the other one is just sick.
One of the flavors is a stranger's flask.
Yeah.
I wrote down in my notes that Joseph Fiennes has big Ross energy.
He does.
Where he's apparently just attractive because he is awkward and shy and doesn't know what to say, I really think Friends sold the world a bill of goods in making it seem like those character traits were attractive to people.
I could not agree with you more. And it's interesting, too, how you said it best, Kenny, earlier, that their occupations, their professions, in no way actually infiltrate the plot of this movie in any way.
Kenny wanted there to be a card tournament. The big card tournament that's happening at the end of the movie that he has to like prepare for and train for.
I needed there to be a card tournament.
I agree.
Actually, like I needed there. It's little things like the idea that these people have lives. Like I appreciated that he sat in the bridge class with the old women, but yes, a card tournament. Give me the card tournament.
Well, it's funny, Kenny, because like, you know, as you were talking about how she's, you know, how she's got no money, it made me think about a much, much better movie, a movie that we talked about a few weeks ago, Girl on the Bridge. And if you got some sort of a situation where she's his good luck charm and they make all this money together or whatever it is, like, listen, it's kind of hacky. It's not a great idea, but at least it fits into kind of, it gives us some stakes. It gives us some plot, something to hold on to. Because I would actually argue, too, that all the actors just feel like they're at sea. Like, they have nothing to hold on to because the script is kind of shit. And there's just – so you feel that as an audience member where they're just like – they're all kind of going through the motions. They're like, okay, I hit my mark. I said my line. But, like, there's nothing here. It's got no pulse.
Question. Yeah. I want to ask you guys a question.
Please.
The premise of this movie is three men, three friends, are all in love with the same woman.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, I feel like I have to note. I my son Rollins, you know, sat down to watch it with me. I figured there was nothing bad there, and there wasn't. And he said, "What's the movie about?" And I told him, "Three men, three friends, in love with the same woman." He's nine. He shook his head and he goes, "Sounds like my life." Which is great.
It's a better line than anything in this movie.
but I only bring it up because I do wonder if there is something, some universality to this premise that may have birthed a more interesting movie. I can't think of a movie that has this premise that's good aside from Something About Mary.
And it's not good. Because this brings me back to the title change. The British poster actually has the premise in the title and the poster.
Correct.
It is Martha meet whatever it is, Daniel.
Frank and Lawrence
or whatever it is. And that is a much more honest title. It is Martha.
Bad, but yeah, it's honest.
Martha prepared to endure these three. That's so much more honest. This one, if it was about three friends who are thrown into conflict because they are all in love with the same woman, that's a story. that's not what this is. Because at most, for most of it, one of the people doesn't realize what's going on, or it's a trick. We can't know this. So this is the, I'm just going to get the rest of the plot out. What's his face? Tom Hollander, who again, I love in all other circumstances.
Yes.
Creeps on this girl. He meets up with his friends. He's like, oh my God, this girl came to London. I'm in love with her. Blah, blah, blah. I sent her flowers to her room. There was a guy there. Oh no, she already forgot about me. How do I get her back? The friends are like, they already hate him. These three never like each other. You don't care. You don't want the friendship to last. No part of this do you get invested in at all. They lose track of her. Rufus Sewell is a drunk, sad actor, goes to an audition, blows it. There doesn't seem to be a reason except for that he just needs to be as sad as possible. He goes to the park, runs into Monica Potter. They spend the afternoon together. He calls Josephine, is like, I've got Tom Hollander's American, seemingly being like, I'm going to try and sleep with her. Out of spite, or I don't know what the fuck he's that. All of that is so gross.
Yeah, that was weird. He's not.
I got her. She's mine.
He's also not like presented as a villain, which clearly he is a villain, and he could have been a villain, and maybe it would be nice to have a villain in this movie. But all right,
maybe. And then all of this roundabout thing, like I said, 45 minutes later, finally Monica Potter and Joseph Fiennes get together. But then we find out that this mystery man that she had seen way at the beginning of the movie was Joseph Fiennes. We do a flashback. They have their fucking meet cute thing, which is not cute at all. It's just kind of weird and convenient. And then that's the movie. But that, so there's two halves of this.
I also want to say, didn't Rufus Sewell at some point describe, or I think it was him, his perfect person as me with breasts?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's not, I mean, something.
Did you have a question?
I had a point. Anybody who thinks that is not my friend.
I think in the 90s, there was stuff like that was pitched as like refreshingly honest, charmingly sort of brutish in a unvarnished way. But it's just kind of like, oh, this guy's just a major creep. In the 90s, and you guys, I'm sure, have seen this a million times and going through 99.
Too many times.
The asshole, the gross asshole who is presented as charming in some way, was very prevalent at that time. And Rufus Sewell is one of those. So anyway, we waste our time with Hollander and Sewell, who are cartoon gross people. Joseph Fiennes has nothing going on. He's a total drip. They fall in love. We're supposed to care. We never care. And we never care about the friendship. In the original pitch and the title and all of this, it is this lifelong. They show us these fucking pictures of them as little kids, arm in arm. The end credits are fucking like it's like a montage of their great, incredible friendship that's lasted their entire life. You watch this in the end credits and you're like, what the fuck?
They really seem like three desperate people. Like there's no connection between
them. It's crazy pill stuff. You get to the end credits and you're like, wait, did this movie think we cared about these three guys and their friendship? This is madness.
Yep. Yeah. It's funny you bring that up because I do think that, you know, another one of the failings of this film is if we were invested in the male friendship that existed, like let's just say, for instance, we did, it actually would create stakes in and of itself too, right?
Sure.
Which is that you'd feel like, well, they all love this woman, but they love each other, and there really is this push and pull. But because that doesn't exist either, there's just no tension in any way throughout the film.
And because of the twist. We find out at the end of the movie that Joseph Fiennes has known what is going on the entire
time.
Movie. So at every point where they're talking about this girl, I'm in love with her. I lost her. The mystery man. Rufus Sewell calls him and is like, I found her. And he's like, don't do anything. All of this time, we find out at the end of the movie, Joseph Fiennes has this entire other level of emotional context because he's in love with her. Mm-hmm. And we're not allowed to know that until an hour and 15 minutes into the fucking movie. So
Which is an hour and 25 minutes.
Did you track it? The length of the movie. Yeah. And again, this goes back to the Westworld problem.
Yep.
All of the characters walk around inert doing nothing because if they do anything, it reveals who they really are, and then that's the twist. So there's no story. It's just people walking around for a season. That is this movie. It's just people, him walking around dead-eyed and sad, and then at the end of the movie, we find out why. We're like, just tell us from the beginning. Have all three of them know that all three of them are in love with her. That's a setup for things to happen.
The reason I love good twists so much is because they're really hard to pull off.
Sure.
Because and so many people don't understand how a twist works. And what they do, Clay, is what you're talking about. They forget that this is a story that you're telling to people. And you would never, if the story on the screen happens in a way that you would never tell people in real life unless you were a total fucking asshole, then I'm not interested.
Your grandma, your mom, remembering a key detail at the end of the story. Be like, oh, by the way, she was wearing a red dress the entire time. And then you're like, oh, well, now it makes sense. Thank you.
It's, you know, the one that will always like stick in my head is Crazy Stupid Love, which for some reason people think is good.
But I think that's wearing off. I think people thinking Crazy Stupid Love is good is fading.
It's the craziest and it's the stupidest.
Crazy.
Idea that this whole movie, they have to refer to their fucking daughter as Nana because it's Hannah Banana because we can't know that the girl is his daughter. Come the fuck on. Like, that is so sweaty in, like, And it does fool some people, but he did it in the This Is Us pilot too.
I was going to say it's the same shit.
You are tricked into thinking that this is all happening on the same timeline when you would never ever tell the story that way unless you were an asshole who doesn't actually like twists. You know, you have to who doesn't actually like telling good stories, because anything can have the twist if you leave out a big fucking detail.
I was just going to say withholding is not clever.
Withholding is not clever.
Key details is not clever. But
and here's, look, 99, which you guys have already, I'm sure, talked about, has one of the great twist movies ever. We got the
Sixth Sense. Two of them.
What's the other one?
I mean, I guess Fight Club could consider.
Oh, Fight Club. Yes. Okay. Well. Both of those are great twists because the twist is a sort of secondary thing. Well, it's Fight Club. It's pretty intrinsic, but there's enough interesting weird shit happening in Fight Club. The story of a Fight Club turning into like a underground, like revolutionary terrorist group, that's a story.
Yes.
Then the split personality thing at the end makes all of it a little bit more interesting. Sixth Sense, a kid who can see dead people is a story. And then finding out the secondary character was dead the whole time adds depth to the whole thing. But like it's like if The Sixth Sense was just this kid went about his life for 2 hours, and then at the end of the movie, it was like, oh, he can see dead people. Half of these people that he interacted with were dead. And you're like,
it's a POV thing, right? So there's a way to do what you just talked about, Clay. If I am, which is what I am, I'm Bruce Willis in that movie. The twist isn't that he can see dead people. The twist is that Bruce Willis is dead, right? But I only know what Bruce Willis knows. I am experiencing the story with Bruce Willis, and when he finds out that he's dead, I find out he's dead, and I am with him emotionally when he figures it out.
Interesting, worthy story.
Totally.
Even without the twist, if the story was about a little kid who can see dead people and a psychiatrist trying to help him deal with that trauma, that is a worthy psychological horror movie without the twist.
All great twists have to work on their merits. But the reason they work on their merits is because you're with the character the whole way.
Right.
And the reason Fight Club works is because you're with the character the whole way. And then the added layer also, you know, kind of explains a lot of what, you know, what we see and puts it in a different light. A movie like Crazy Stupid Love, if you're with Ryan Gosling the entire movie, and you never go into the Julianne Moore, Steve Carell house, then you could start to, then there is something there. But because I'm in this house and these characters are well fucking aware that Nana is their daughter and that anybody else would be calling their daughter at some point by their daughter's name or have a picture of their daughter or include their daughter in
Nana?
Their
family.
in some way, it is just a joke on me. The only person right. who is surprised by what's happening at the end is me.
And through the whole movie, the characters cannot say or do anything meaningful because it would give away the twist that they want to blow everybody's minds with at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
The end of, I remember seeing Crazy Stupid Love in the theater, and I remember people, like, there were audible holy shits. Like, I remember people just feeling like their minds were fucking blown. And I just remember thinking, like, what? Like, why did this happen? Why did we, by the way, like, why did we even need that? Like, it actually doesn't make the movie any better in terms of, like, anyway, it doesn't matter.
Anyway.
It actually, like, what kills me about it is it's the fucking Hitchcock suspense versus surprise. I can't tell you how many times I'm in a writer's room where people prioritize surprise over suspense.
Yep.
And you just start to be like, guys, think about 95% of the movies you like. It's the suspense. Think about the opening of Inglourious Basterds. It's the suspense that fucking kills you. Occasionally, surprise is great. Occasionally, it works. But don't underestimate the power of knowing more than the characters.
Well, and I would also say, you know, we're about to talk about a movie that does suspense quite well, I think, for the majority of the film. We'll talk about that. But in terms of suspense versus surprise in that film, I think
it's an interesting thing.
It's an interesting thing we'll talk about. But let's just fucking rate this so we can move on with our lives. because on some level, it's like, you know, we've covered the plot. We've covered everything that happens in it. And
we didn't even mention, we talked about Ray Winstone a little bit, but this also has a very 1999 framing device of the lead character spilling their guts to a therapist who then, look, that's the only twist that the movie needed was the end. Yeah. When it turned out that Ray Winstone wasn't the psychiatrist, he was just a guy. That's a joke I kind of liked. Because Ray Winstone plays it very well. I like Ray Winstone a lot.
I didn't hate it either, but I did still, you know, and this is like movie logic, like bullshitty stuff that like I would, in a better movie, I wouldn't give a shit about. But like, why did he go to that apartment? What exactly is happening?
Well, he's an insane person who makes no rational decisions in the entire movie.
Fair.
I do think it's amazing, though, that of all the actors in this film, Ray Winstone's the one who's had the most illustrious career.
Yeah. Well, was that a cameo at that point? I have a hard time tracking how famous some of those British people were in the UK at any given time. Like, I know that Ray Winstone had been acting since like the early 80s. So he may have been like a Ray Winstone kind of addition into that.
I'm curious now, but
do I have any stray notes? Oh, at the end of the movie, when she's in Josephine's apartment and sees the photo of all three of them together, I wrote, that's some horror movie shit. And it really is. Like I would run and run and run and never stop running if I saw that.
Ray Winstone had been acting for probably about 15 years before this film came out, but I don't ultimately think he really became big until, I mean, what was Ray Winstone's big? Was it Sexy Beast? Feels like when I first noticed him.
It was a couple years after this was Sexy Beast. Look, I will say one thing I did like. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to find a silver lining here.
Okay.
I do think a couple, and I mentioned this earlier, I think a couple of the isolated lines were okay. I do like when Ray Winstone at the end of the movie says, "You didn't come to me because you can't make a decision. You came to me because you aren't happy with the decision you already made." I like that line. I like Ray Winstone.
It's fine. Okay.
No, in context of what we all had just experienced for the last hour and a half, that seems like lightning from the gods' wisdom
I agree with that.
Shakespeare to Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I did not see this film in 99, so I can't review it back then. Before this podcast, I gave this film a 30, but after this podcast, I'm at a 20.
Mr. Generous over there.
Out of a cool hundo?
99.
Out of a cool 99.
I mean, there's nothing really to ride for here. Truly, I think there's, you know, I do think that Monica Potter is charming to a certain degree. That's maybe the best thing I can say about this film. What about you, Kenny? What do you think?
When I have a little blurb to read, I like to read it.
Please read it.
This might be one of our worst.
Yep.
This is an inept piece of Weinstein crap.
Yep.
Not offensive, but my score must reflect how terrible this is in every stage, particularly because I think this is an aggressively trite movie that has delusions of grandeur. So I do agree with you, Clay. I do think like it. They did think that they were doing something that may be a great film.
Yeah,
and the Daily Mail clearly agreed with them. I gave it a 22 before this podcast. I'm going to go down to a 17.
Fair.
This is a bad movie, a bad, bad, bad movie made by bad people.
I don't know if it's made by bad people, but it's a bad movie.
Made by Weinstein and
Peter Morgan, he's a bad person.
Who's our best person? So a bad person and our best person.
Yes, there you go.
And Nick Hamm, who we went ham on appropriately.
Clay, what do you think?
Ham. Well, I've seen this movie twice now.
Insane.
Again, out of just pure curiosity on a Monica Potter basis, and I will say the rest of the cast, not Joseph Fiennes, but mm-hmm. I am a big Tom Hollander fan. I mentioned that a couple of times. I love whenever he shows up. I mean, Phil, we're both huge fans of the Pirates movies. We got some Tom Hollander in there, some very good Tom Hollander in there.
He's very good in that.
Yeah. He's very good in Hannah. He's very good in Pride and Prejudice. He's very good in everything I've seen him in. Controversial movie, but I ride for Richard Curtis's About Time. He's very funny in About Time. I like Tom Hollander. So I saw that. I was like, oh, shit, Tom Hollander, Rufus Sewell, Man in the High Castle. This is all good stuff. I like all of this. Saw the movie and did not remember a second of it.
How long ago did you see this movie?
Maybe 4 years ago.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
And I did not remember a second of it. Would have given it just because I didn't remember it. I wasn't angry about it. I had not. I hadn't gotten all ginned up by the two of you over it yet. I gave it maybe like a 33. I don't know. It's like a C minus. Upon second watch in this discussion, I feel like, I don't know. I feel like we're down. I'm in between Kenny and Phil. I'm at a 19.
Fair point.
19.
But it's
I am curious. So next week we are, we're doing Carrie to the Rage. Yes.
I didn't know we're doing that. Sounds exciting.
I mean, we're eventually doing it.
I'm going to have to rewatch Carrie 1, I guess.
I mean, you should probably watch Carrie 1 again. If you haven't, you've seen it though, right, Kenny?
Oh, yeah. De Palma completist.
Yeah, we're Becky Feldman's going to come on to talk about Carrie 2, The Rage. The reason I bring this up, Clay,
I love Becky. She's so funny. That's great.
Becky's great. It's going to be great. I'm sure you haven't seen Carrie 2, The Rage, right, Clay? Have you seen it?
I have not seen Carrie 2,
The
Rage.
But you've seen
the
original Carrie, right?
I have seen the original Carrie, yes.
Do you have thoughts on the original Carrie?
I remember, it's been 7 or 8 years, but I remember it being very good. I mean, Kenny said he's seen Carrie 1 because he's a De Palma completist, and then he said, I'm just kidding. I don't know how to unpack that, because being a De Palma completist is not something you would have to kid about. Nor would being a De Palma completist need to be the reason to watch Carrie, one of the best regarded coming of age films ever made.
I'll unpack it for you real fast. I think De Palma's no good.
Wow.
And
like just across the board?
No. I think he's made some spectacular films.
Okay.
I also think he's made some spectacular misses.
Correct.
Like some just awful, awful, terrible films. Uh-huh. But he's a really interesting guy. I read the book about The Making of Bonfire of the Vanities, and mm-hmm. I think in that there's a lot of De Palma in there, mm-hmm. and I'm kind of fascinated by the movie brat thing, where four of those guys go on to be four of the 10 best American filmmakers of all time, and then there's De Palma, who is a great American filmmaker, but he's not them. So that's very interesting to me. I don't think that that's lost on him when he makes his films. I do think that De Palma actively is always shooting for that Coppola, Scorsese, Spielberg, Lucas thing. So I love that about him, and I think he misses wildly so often. And I also think his great films are not nearly at that level either. But
I fully agree with you.
I have a very good friend, Manny Figueroa, who like thinks De Palma is one of the best filmmakers of all time. Yeah. And Manny's such a smart guy, and it really is, you know, forced me to kind of reevaluate. But
yeah. I watched and I don't know if you watched the documentary that Noah Baumbach did on De Palma, which came out a few years ago.
Yeah, it's great.
It's fantastic, and it really made me reevaluate the misses in a blank checky kind of way. Like that this guy was doing some interesting stuff, and I respect the swings.
Definitely. And honest filmmaker.
100%. I think Carrie's an interesting film. I've not seen Carrie 2. I did see the Carrie remake that Kimberly Pierce did with Chloe Moretz, whenever that was, probably about 10 years ago now or something like that, which is not a good movie, but was shot at my high school. So it was nice to see my high school burn to the ground.
Very cool. Very cool.
That was kind of cool. Well, Clay.
Oh, I should say also, please. Phil.
Yes.
I texted you a couple of days ago and said, I've got a twist of my own.
Yeah.
In keeping with the theme with this film.
Yeah, please.
I have just discovered that there is not one, but two Monica Potter films that came out in 1999.
Please, yes. Talk about this other film that you've only you have seen.
The other film is called Heaven or Vegas. Monica Potter is not the star. She is third billed. This is a movie about Richard Grieco. Richard Grieco from 21 Jump Street.
Trump supporter, I believe.
Trump supporter. And Yasmin Bleeth from Baywatch as a male hooker and a female hooker, respectively, escaping Vegas to go on the road and find a better life. They end up in, I don't know, Montana or Idaho or something, with Yasmin Bleeth's father and step family, where Richard Grieco falls in love with the virginal, sweet Monica Potter, who is Yasmin Bleeth's stepsister. I made it 25 minutes into this movie and said, it's not worth it.
Oh, really?
I was going to do a whole bit where I went deep on Heaven or Vegas. It's on Tubi, and that's the only place it is. so you know it's good. I do love Tubi as a service. They have the most exquisite garbage on there. In addition to real movies, they have real movies as well. But
I watched Sea of Love on Tubi.
Did you? Oh, there you go.
No, it was IMDb TV.
Oh, I knew I watched.
Oh, with ads.
I watched something recently on Tubi.
I have the Blu-ray. No, Tubi is cool.
Is Tubi watching? Man. I was going to say Kenny's a Pluto man. Kenny loves Pluto.
Oh, it's very similar. I've been watching made for television Madchen Amik movies from the early 90s on Tubi. Yeah. So it's a great resource for stuff like that. Anyway, Heather Vegas.
I'm watching Twin Peaks from the start right now, and I get it, dude.
Can I just say that I
watch Sleepwalkers. Kenny, have you seen Sleepwalkers?
No. The only thing I've ever seen her in before Twin Peaks was Riverdale. So I knew nothing about it.
Madchen Amick.
Madchen Amick, Dream Lover with James Spader. It's a great movie. Sleepwalkers, Mick Garris's Sleepwalkers, which is was written or is based on a Stephen King book, is a real fucking weird movie.
Yeah. She's so good in Twin Peaks.
She's so good in it. Oh. And there's a scene, which if this appeals to me, because we used to record our podcast at the Arrow Theater in Santa Monica, Screen Drafts. There's a scene where she is working as a movie theater employee at the Arrow. And she's cleaning up at the end of the night and she's listening to a song on her Walkman. And it's just like a 3-minute scene of her dancing around the lobby of the Arrow. It's maybe my favorite.
Yep.
Sleepwalkers. Maybe my favorite scene in any movie.
You just sold me.
it's also about an incestual
werewolf
cult. Yeah.
Cool.
Well, guys, if you're not listening to Screen Drafts, you're doing it wrong. You should be listening to Screen Drafts. It's great. Kenny and I have had the pleasure of being on it. We hope to be on it again in the future.
Absolutely. I'm pitching Clay daily on new things.
Kenny has turned into a real Graham Skipper, just
a real peppering Graham Skipper.
peppering me with very good draft ideas, and we will have you guys on.
But again, I saw that. Absolutely. I saw that that Dave Schilling barely missed out on doing professional wrestlers movies, not starring.
It was very close. It was very close.
I would love to throw my hat in the ring.
I'd love to listen to that.
That topic is still out there in the ether.
If Schilling will have me, I would love to do it.
Oh yeah, you and Schilling.
That sounds like one for the books. Sounds incredible. Yeah.
You are the first people that come to mind when I think of professional wrestling, and a surprising number of people on who I follow on Twitter. I always forget professional wrestling exists, and then WrestleMania happens, and it seems like 75% of the people I follow on Twitter are huge wrestling fans. It surprises me every time.
I'm sure if you haven't listened to our episode on Beyond the Mat, you should, with Kenny and Dave talking wrestling. But if you're also interested,
I did listen to that, and I learned so much.
Also, Play It to the Bone has a good half hour segment of that episode where Kenny and Christian Lander talk wrestling.
We talk 99 like WCW,
talk 99 wrestling. Like
that's true. I forgot about that.
It's a good swath of that episode. Yeah,
it was so big in 99. It comes up. I mean, the Muppet movie. All over the place in 99.
And we still have to do a WrestleMania episode as well, Kenny.
I know. And I mean, as soon as you are double vaxxed, you can come over. Yes. And we will
watch that shit.
Yep. We'll watch all 6 hours of WrestleMania.
It's 6 hours long?
The best, I don't know if it's 6 hours, and I don't know if I would make
people
you watch
were tweeting thing. About it for like 3 days as if it was still happening.
The one this year was over two nights.
Yeah, it was crazy.
But in 99, the cool thing about 99, and the reason it's relevant to this day is The Rock was the top guy.
Right.
So, you'll watch The Rock and Steve Austin had their, their first match in the main event of that thing. So if there was ever a moment, ever a time to watch wrestling, and it's nuts. Like the shit that happened then was crazy. So, yes, we will do that episode at some point.
It's going to be great. I can't wait.
Yep.
We're done.
Anyway, screen drafts.
This is great. Screen drafts is great. We can't wait to be back on. You also have a Patreon as well, right? Mm. There's a screen drafts Patreon.
Like you guys, we do have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/screendrafts. Bonus stuff every month. We have a schedule of like once every 2 or 3 months, we have a patrons versus episode where we bring on a fan favorite guest GM. The patrons come up with ideas for topics. They vote. We pick a topic. Then the patrons send us their ranked 7 title lists.
Oh, wow. Okay.
From that topic, I curate that into what I believe is the most representative list of the patrons' will. Uh-huh. That is given to a proxy and they play against. They represent the patrons versus our guest GM. This month, it is going to be Dave Schilling. Yep. The topic that ended up winning the poll was comedians' first dramatic leads films.
Okay.
Really interesting, weird topic. I've received a very disparate slate of picks from the patrons. So we're recording that. That'll be up. I mean, you're listening to this months on. So that'll be in the Patreon. But my co-host, Ryan Marker, and I also do what we call the franchise mini super drafts, where we pick 5 film franchises. And these are also voted on by the patrons, but franchises that have 5 movies. Uh-huh. And it's just Ryan and I going head to head on these mini super drafts. We've done 11 or 12 franchises. Twilight was a real banger. The Pirates one was... Kenny, I think you would enjoy listening to that. I think you and Ryan are perhaps
I love Ryan.
Hive mind.
When I was on your podcast, it was really important to me that I got Ryan's sign off, and it really hurts my heart that he hates Top Gun so much. But the reason it hurts my heart is because I deserve no blame for that. Phil killed the Good Plane movie in favor of the Bad Plane movie.
Yeah, because Connor sucks.
That's an interesting take. Connor rules.
In retrospect, I kind of wish I went with American Gigolo. But okay, what are you going to do?
Here's what I just want to say this as we wrap up. I think we did a phenomenal job on our Bruckheimer draft.
It was a great draft.
It was a great draft, and I think we absolutely got Ryan on board by the end. I think that Ryan was a big fan of what we did on that draft.
Yeah, you guys are in good standing with my co-host, Ryan Marker. But yeah, look, the regular show is Screen Drafts. It's everywhere. You find podcasts. It's competitive list making with two people alternating picks. Listen to the one with Phil and Kenny doing Jerry Bruckheimer. If you like that, explore further.
I thought you were going to say listen to the episode with Dana and I, which gets real contentious. Dana listen Schwartz and I.
That's good, too.
If you guys want to hear us go toe-to-toe on Reality Bites, that's the episode to listen to.
Who knew? Who knew that Reality Bites would be such a Waterloo? Like,
You never know.
I really honestly believe I'd never been on the podcast before when I came out with Dana. Uh-huh. But the look of shock and awe that Ryan and you both had at what was transpiring and how uncomfortable you were by it was really something. So
We love when it gets a little messy.
Do you have the video of that? I'd love to see it.
I do have the video of that. Yes, I referred to it back when you guys were going to be on the show. Because if we have like vetoes, if you don't use them, you can roll them over. I had to refer back, and because Phil and I had differing memories of if he had a rollover veto, so I had to check the tape. And Kenny, I'll send you that.
I would love to see video of just the Reality Bite segment. I think that's
That's what I would watch. I'm not going to.
Phil makes some incredible faces.
it was crazy.
You're funny that I mean now we're going real deep on this podcast, but the annoying thing to me about that is we pitched this podcast as two people who aren't afraid to mix it up,
right?
and we never mix it up. Occasionally, 200 episodes or something, like occasionally we get into it. But for the most part, it's remarkable how often we just agree and we're just nice to each other. Mm-hmm. But you get more into it with Dana in that episode than you've gotten into it with me in anything we've done.
Kenny is jealous, Phil, that you're you guys are too in line. You have too good of a relationship.
Because that's how I flirt. So like you're fighting with someone else when you're supposed to be exclusive with me. It's very upsetting.
But it's because we agree because we both have good taste. Dana has very good taste. But Dana was just like throwing a grenade into the situation just because
I know
it was a crazy situation. Anyway, I know. Clay, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh my god. The thing I love about this is I love talking to you guys. Also, on our show, we do mostly talk about good movies because it is like best of stuff.
Sure.
So usually we're talking about movies that are all pretty good. Love the chance to really pick apart something that just plain doesn't work. Usually a more fun conversation for me. So I thank you for indulging me. You could have easily said, technically, The Very Thought of You / Martha Meet These Three Assholes is a 1998 movie. Said we're not going to do it, but my weird thing with Monica Potter continues, and it flourishes. Mm-hmm. And if there was a way I could convince you that U.S. Marshals came out in 1999, I would insist we do that. That's my other Monica Potter level. Kenny, how did you put it?
I worked myself into a shoot.
So I've got several of those. This is the only one that applies to your show. So thank you for having me on. This was a lot.
All right. We'll be doing a Patreon with Clay.
Clay's coming on for Sea of Love, and we're going to talk with him about that.
Good movie.
It's going to be great. One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hannah, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episode, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.